From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1985 with the creation of a nuisance abatement program in the city of Rochester. The goal was fairly straightforward. Take down drug dens or properties that have become havens for criminals. Neighborhoods can suffer when such properties are around. By the mid-1990s, as noted by the Democrat and Chronicle, the city updated the program and specified 35 nuisance categories along with a point system. But now that system is being challenged and reviewed, and former Mayor Bill Johnson is helping in a way to lead that review. Now, some listeners have brought up New York City. A report from ProPublica finds that the nuisance abatement program there tends to target minority families for eviction, and they are often not able to defend themselves in court. In Rochester, there are different issues at play, but former Mayor Johnson has indicated that the program can be improved and strengthened. So this hour, we're going to take a look at the system. Tonight marks the first of four community forums focused on nuisance property enforcement. We'll let you know about where you can go to attend if you'd like to do that. Bill Johnson's here. He's the former mayor of Rochester, and he's the CEO of Strategic Community Intervention. Thank you for being here, Bill. Nice to see you back.
Thank you, as always, Evan. Good to be back.
Well, let's just sort of do a little comparison for listeners who brought up New York City right out of the gate. You view New York City's nuisance abatement program and Rochester's nuisance abatement program as separate, different, not really on parallel tracks there?
Yes, even though the ordinance would focus a lot of attention on residential property, a lot of the attention goes to commercial properties in Rochester, and that's really one of the issues that people are complaining about, because you have bitter opposition on the part of property owners who say that this is an unfair and highly discretionary and arbitrary system. So I think the issues are to be separated and worthy of discussion here.
Okay. So why don't we talk about what the actual nuisance abatement program really is about, Bill, and how it has come to work in this city. I think some of our listeners they're certainly familiar with the notion of wanting to make sure there aren't properties that are crime-ridden or nuisance properties that hurt neighborhoods. But why don't you give me a little history of the program, how it works, and how it's meant to work?
Well, as you indicated, the history goes back to 85, but by 1996, when I was in office, when there was a lot of focus on quality of life, believe it or not, the intent of this was a sort of a neighborhood preservation action to really intervene with properties that were not being taken care of by either their owner or their tenants, that were in violation of property codes. And some houses, which we now use the term zombie houses, but there were a lot of abandoned properties that were being used for illicit purposes. So people were taking over these houses and they were doing drugs and other kinds of things. And in certain instances, high crimes were being committed. In fact, back in 2015, there was this issue here in Rochester on Woodward Street. Some will remember a house that was being used illicitly where there were a lot of parties, where neighbors were complaining bitterly to the city to do something about it, to take that house out of circulation. It was owned by someone who didn't live in the city of Rochester, not properly managed. They had shootings there. And then they had two homicides that occurred at that property. And then the city moved in rather quickly to shut it down. And, of course, the neighbor's objection was, what took you so long? We've been complaining about this property for months, if not years. And when you go around the city, you find people who will say that. This property has been standing in this neglected condition. Nothing seems to happen. Why can't the city use its codes for the end purpose that it was intended? So this is why the city finally decided to have a third party look at this system to determine whether or not it was being applied uniformly, consistently, and effectively. And when we went in and did what nobody had done, really, in years, go and look at the records. We examined 5,600 files of properties for which points had been assessed. We found that the results were very uneven, that it wasn't through negligence, it wasn't through capriciousness on the part of the city. It was just that way that it was too much flexibility that was built into the system. And so you need a consistent system.
Is flexibility another word for arbitrariness?
No, saying, oh, if I sit down with you, if we cite you, because remember, the first thing that happens is you get a warning.
Yep.
Okay? So that is to bring you in and talk to people at the city. And if I had the property owner come in and sit down and have a discussion, and they said, oh, they make a decision. Oh, okay, this guy looks like a decent guy. He's putting forth a good faith effort. Why don't we suspend any action? And sometimes that property owner will evict the client, will change something about the way that property is operated, and you'll never hear from them again. And then other times you remove one bad tenant and you replace them with another, and the problem continues. So we believe that there has to be some standards that are established, and that people need to understand inside the city exactly what's being enforced, what's not going to be enforced, because the code does say flagrant violations, okay? So that the code itself recognizes that you can't take care of all of these minor problems. But there's got to be a consistent pattern. And I think the good part of this, even before a suit was filed challenging the constitutionality, the city recognized that it had a problem and that it needed to go in after 20 years of implementing this one way and find a better way of providing what is a very essential service.
Okay, we're talking to former Mayor Bill Johnson, who is the CEO of Strategic Community Intervention. And as a consultant, he is helping lead this review of the city's nuisance abatement program. There are four community forums this week. And I know that the city and Strategic Community Intervention would love for you to attend, to weigh in, to learn more, to communicate with them. If you go, here are four of them. Tonight, 6 to 8 p.m. at New Bethel Church, New Bethel CME, that's on Scio Street. 6 to 8 tonight. Tomorrow, there's two different community forums, from 2 to 4 at the Five Star Bank on Westfall Road. Again, that's 2 to 4 at the Five Star Bank on Westfall Road tomorrow, and 6 to 8 at the Dazzle Theater on Webster Avenue in the southeast section. Dazzle Theater at Webster Avenue, 6 to 8. And then on Thursday, 6 to 8, in the Stardust Ballroom on Bacchus Street. That's in the northwest section. Stardust Ballroom, Thursday, 6 to 8. What are you hoping to hear at these public forums, these community forums, Bill?
Well, we know that these hearings are not for everyone. They really are for people who are very intimately and directly involved in the system. But what we want to do is to show that the city is very serious, and not just to come in, work in some back room, come up with a better design, come back to the residents and say, what do you think about this? But right from the beginning, and tonight's session will prove it, the bulk of the time that we're going to be meeting is going to be engaged in interaction for the people who are there to answer a series of questions. What's wrong with the system today from your point of view as a user? All right, what should happen in this system, and how do we design those elements in it? We go back now to the various department heads. We're dealing with issues like training of personnel. We're dealing with public reporting systems that can be easily accessed so that if you're a citizen, you can go online like you can do right now and check a variety of things about what's going on in the city. What's happening with the property at 10 Brown Street? All right, for example, you can find it, and it'll give you an up-to-date stat. We have to help work with the city to design those systems. There's now a what quote is called an experiment, but it's been going on for 6 years, that they have a citizen review panel in the Southwest to look at these cases, which is a peer review panel. They set this up. We found that when we examined it, that it worked very well, and we could not understand why it had not been implemented citywide. So that's another one of the outcomes that's going to be coming, to get citizens, you know, trained so they can actually be involved in the disposition of these cases. And then there are two very significant issues that we discovered. One by sheer accident. There is Section 3-15, which is known as the nuisance abatement part of the city charter. There's another Chapter 13A, which is the Municipal Code Violations Bureau. And we were hearing from people saying, oh, the city's putting all this emphasis on drug houses, on violence and the like. 85% of those violations, those points that assess in those cases, in four areas, 31 pretty much go unenforced. And yet, in the Municipal Code Violations Bureau, we found that tickets were being assessed for property code violations, for noise, for loitering, for unruly dogs, thousands of tickets. And it's not just a revenue issue, although it does generate revenue, But what we're finding is that these two systems were not communicating with each other. So it was people who were upset because they didn't see a point violation being assessed against a property didn't realize that the property owner or the tenant had been cited in a civil action, and they had to appear down on St. Paul Street at the municipal code violation, and they would end up paying a fine. We really want to find what the overlap is in those two systems. And then finally, why so much emphasis placed on four, you know, 85% on four areas, why under 31 being enforced? And it may be that there are other ways to deal with that problem. So in our 6 months of evaluation, we uncovered these problems. Now we are given the opportunity to go back and look at them in more detail to find out if there are actually answers to resolve these inherent inconsistencies that are in the system.
844-295-TALK. If you want to weigh in on nuisance abatement with former Mayor Bill Johnson, who is the CEO of Strategic Community Intervention, 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Let me read a comment from Tristan on Twitter that I think is indicative of some of the suspicion that some of our community has. I mean, certainly, I don't want to say all. This is not an issue I've studied all that closely, Bill, but Tristan writes, Evan, nuisance abatement typically means denying rights of homeless citizens and a further excuse to criminalize property. You're shaking your head already. Go ahead.
No, because the violation is against the property. So if you're homeless, by definition, you don't have any property. I think that there are people who kind of conflate two separate issues. There is a homeless problem in this city and a serious one. And people look at the fact that there's so many vacant properties and say, well, why can't we fill up these vacant properties with people who obviously need housing? That's an entirely separate and distinct issue. What I think Tristan and others should understand is this. If you do not have effective code enforcement, if you do not go in when a problem is just beginning, and this is what the nuisance abatement program does. It's at the beginning. Somebody observes something, a code inspector, a police officer, or a resident, because this is a complaint-driven system. The police don't go to somebody's house until there is a complaint through either 911 or 311. And the people said, this problem is beginning to fall into neglect, okay? You don't wait until the house starts falling down. You try to go in and correct it to keep it from falling down. And I think that people have failed to recognize, because they think there's something punitive, there is an element of punishment. If, after being given the opportunity to voluntarily correct a problem on your own, you don't do it, then the city attaches a penalty, but not 1 minute before. It's always giving the owner the opportunity to correct the problem.
And that's where I think there's the most significant distinction between this Rochester review and the review that's being conducted in New York City, because as ProPublica found, they found a lot of people evicted without much chance to defend themselves. And I think I can assume that you would find that terribly problematic if that were the case here, but you're saying that is not the case here.
Yeah, and let me just say, though, that point is very much correct. And let me say that part of what you're dealing with in New York City is a gentrification problem. I mean, you've got rent control. We don't have that here. You've got properties which have exceedingly high value in the marketplace if, in fact, the owner could take it and convert it to market rate, all right? So that's what you've got there. So, yes, hundreds of thousands of people in New York City are being victimized by that kind of action. But I don't want to be too glib here. There is a lawsuit currently in Supreme Court challenging Rochester's ordinance based on the fact that the city police department observed drug activity occurring outside of a residence, all right, out on the street of the residence. And they went and they did three buys, and they issued three tickets of violation. At that point, those tickets carried six-point violations, 18 points. City can take action against you now, all right? The owner of the property—
How many points do you need to take action?
You need 12 points within 6 months or 18 points within a year.
Got it.
And once you got that. But what we're finding is there are a lot of properties with more than 18 points against which no action was being taken. So there's something wrong with that system, all right? Again, We found nothing deliberate, or illegal, or illicit in what the city was doing. It's just inattention.
Consistency.
That's just a word I can use.
Okay.
But here's the point of this lawsuit. The owner of the property, recognizing what was going on, it was in the northeast section of Rochester, was in frequent contact with the Rochester Police Department and said to them, we'll give you access to our house if you want to come and set up surveillance, because the problem is not inside my building. It's out on the street corner. It's the people who don't live here. None of these people were residents who, for whatever reason, maybe it was at a cross section or intersection or whatever, who decided that this is where they want to set up their business, their illegal operation. So the building owner has a record of offering to work with the police department. The residents, one in particular, called incessantly to the police department. And they said, well, there's nothing we can do about that, you know, until, you know, something blah, blah, blah happens. And only when that owner came home one day and found drugs stashed in his mailbox, because I guess the police were getting so close, they had to hide the drugs. And he took it out and he called 911. And only when the owner of those drugs left a message on his phone saying, if I don't get my property back, something bad's going to happen to you. A threat was made. Then they came. What did they do? Did they arrest the guys on the street who were selling the drugs? No. They issued a violation against the property. We think that's wrong and that needs to change, that the police department needs to use whatever resources at its disposal to take that person off the street. And if they say, oh, well, we're going to arrest them, they're going to go to city court, they're going to be back out on the street tomorrow, they're going to go right back to that same corner, and they're going to start their illicit activity over again, arrest them the second time. At some point, the system has got to kick in. So when the city issued this warning, they shut that house down for 12 months. They withdrew the certificate of occupancy. This is what is alleged in the court papers. And what they say is, we're being penalized. I'm going to lose my residence. The owner's going to lose his revenue. And the person out on the street selling. So there's got to be some way to remediate this problem without affecting the lives of innocent people. And I think on that one point, both property owners and neighborhood leaders agree. There's got to be probably a different way of administering this system.
Michelle writes to us and says, Evan, I think what your emailer, and I think she means Tristan on Twitter, was talking about is the fact that we still have a homeless population that feels constantly targeted, that feels like if they find a home that's not being used, that they can't even feel safe sleeping for the night. And I wonder what the former mayor has to say to people in that circumstance.
You won't find anybody more sympathetic to the plight of the homeless. Let me tell you, I spent a fair amount of my time during my 12 years trying to deal with that problem. That is a legitimate problem. I would not make any attempt to demean or diminish the importance of that problem. But it's separate and apart from what we're talking about here, okay? Because nobody can just walk into a property and take it over and say, oh, it's vacant. I'm going to sleep here. I mean, you know, many of those properties are in very, very bad condition, all right? They're not heated. Who would say that it's okay for a homeless person to go spend a night in a place without any facilities, no running water, no access to good toilet and sanitary facilities? I think there's another way. And for those people who advocate to the city, and they certainly did it when I was in office, find a way to take some of those properties that are just standing unused. Find a way to convert those into useful public facilities where homeless people can reside. I certainly would be leading in that kind of conversation.
And I think, Megan Mack will correct me, I think we had a conversation in the spring regards to a community group that wants to do essentially that it's kind of a community bank of or a community trust of homes and properties that could be used in exactly that way. That landlords, instead of letting properties become sort of derelict and fallen apart, could donate and could turn them over, and they would be managed in this way. Is the time come for something like that?
Yeah, and if, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe Buckingham Properties mm-hmm. took a property up off of West Main Street, and for the winter allowed that property. They ran heat in it, and they created good living conditions. But that was not a
permanent... For the House of Mercy.
Not necessarily the House of Mercy. This is up there near DePaul. This is up there off of West Main Street. Property that it owned, that it was not being used. So they decided, hey, here's a humanitarian thing that we can do. I applaud that kind of effort. But as a temporary solution. The people who say to the city, okay, take all these vacant houses. Well, in the first place, the ones that the city acquires title to are probably the best thing for them is to tear them down. Because nobody's going to walk away from an income-producing property, okay? They've reached a point where they are totally worthless, which means thousands and thousands of dollars had to be put in to bring those up. Now there are organizations that do that now. The Urban League does that. A bureau does that. They take houses, they rehabilitate them, but they do it so they can put them out for rent, generate income. So it's a complicated discussion. I don't want to come down on the side of that I'm opposed to this idea. I think there's really grounds to have a serious discussion about what we do to all of these properties that are being abandoned and causing huge problems in not only mere eyesores, but they are magnets for the worst kind of behavior, and they should not be allowed to stand in the condition that they're in.
Megan Mack, producer of Connections, confirms for me, the group's called Take Back the Land, and we'll certainly follow up with them as we move into 2017 and try to get a handle on how they have been doing when it comes to creating this kind of a community trust of properties. But back to the issue at hand and getting ready to sort of close the loop. And listeners, by the way, as we go through into our second half hour, we're going to talk to the former mayor about a number of other topics. I know he wants to weigh in on the last week's election and some other things. So if you want to call in, it's 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You have praised Mayor Warren and this administration for wanting to address this system in a way that makes it functional and more consistent. Yeah. So I know these four community forums that are this week will help you learn a little bit more here. But ultimately, what do you think the most important step that the city is going to be able to take to make nuisance abatement fair, to not target people unfairly, to make sure neighborhoods are protected, frustrated neighbors who see these kind of quote-unquote problem properties? What's step one you see, Bill?
Well, step one has got to be to find a way to address the frustration that a number of people have with the system for several different reasons. You've got residents who are bitterly complaining about the continued existence of these eyesores in their neighborhoods. And we're not talking about weeks and months. We're talking about years. And sometimes there's a legitimate reason why the city can't take action. But at least there needs to be communication around that. Secondly, you've got landlords who are in a very, very difficult situation. Let me tell you, I'm not anti-landlord. And that will shock some of them because some of the people go way back to the time when we created the system and they felt that they were being maligned and their revenue streams were being impacted. They provide a very useful service. There are people who cannot afford to buy their own houses. There are people who cannot afford to move to good housing in the suburbs. So we have to rely upon these property owners, these property managers, these landlords to continue to provide a constant stream of safe, sanitary, and decent housing. And many of them do that, even though the profit margins are shrinking. But they, too, have expressed a real concern. Why should I, as a property owner, bear the brunt of this system? Why are you penalizing me and just assuming that I'm a bad guy or a bad girl? So I think that the city is now understanding that it has to listen to legitimate concerns from whatever quarter they come and to respond, not just listen, okay, I hear you, but to say, what can we do to address your concerns? And this is an easy one. Let me tell you, of all the problems that the city is faced with today, this pales in comparison to the concerns people have about the way public safety is being administered. The city has an opportunity, I think, to do something, you know, very, very, I was going to use the word spectacular, but I don't want to go that far, but at least something that's good and responsive. And I think that they're moving in the direction to do that.
Four community forums open to the public starting tonight on this nuisance property enforcement issue. Tonight, 6 to 8 p.m. in the Northeast. That's at the New Bethel CME Church on Scio. Tonight, 6 to 8 p.m. Then two tomorrow, one on Thursday. Who's running these meetings? You, the city of Rochester?
No, the consultant.
Okay.
We're running them, yeah.
I don't know if the full schedule of meetings is posted anywhere, but we'll make sure that we can post it online.
Yeah, it was in this morning to DNC.
Oh, very good. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's get our only break of the hour, and we'll come back with former Rochester Mayor Bill Johnson, who is the CEO of Strategic Community Intervention. You want to touch back and weigh in on nuisance abatement and related matters in the city, dealing with so-called problem properties and the fairest and best way forward, you can do that. We're also going to talk about the election and other issues as well. So we continue with Bill Johnson after this only break of the hour on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on the next Connections, small business owners voted for Donald Trump more than 2-1 over Hillary Clinton. And we're going to welcome several of them from our area. They'll talk about their optimism for a Trump White House, their hopes for how Trump might govern in regards to dealing with regulations in small businesses, their hopes for growth and hiring in the future. We'll talk about small business and Donald Trump next on Connections Tuesday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Bill Johnson's the former mayor of Rochester. He has been involved in a number of elections in his career. He's won some big ones. He's lost some big ones. He's been on all sides of it. And so Bill knows no matter what side you were on last Tuesday, you can't win them all, whether it's 4 years ago, 8 years ago, or just last Tuesday. Having said that, how are you feeling? You've always sort of struck me as an optimist. How do you feel?
Well, I have to say, I'm the farther away I get from last Tuesday evening, the better I feel.
Okay.
Even though I watched Donald Trump last night on 60 Minutes, I watched almost all of that. I watched the news this morning when they announced Steve Bannon. I mean, I think we're going to have our moments where Donald Trump's going to surprise us in many ways in a positive way, and he's going to shock us in many ways in a negative way. And I watched last night, and I think many of us would be startled when he says he doesn't grasp the enormity of this opposition. Not because he was elected. I don't think there's anybody I've heard that says, you know, we need to overthrow this election. I think that people are saying he doesn't understand how he was elected and the fact that he was appealing to such wide and disparate points of view. So let me just make two quick observations. I'm a Southerner, and I travel back to my native state of Virginia every month to take care of my 96-year-old mother, okay? And up until a few months ago, my middle daughter and her family lived in North Carolina. And so I would do two for one. I'd go to North Carolina, I'd drive up to Lynchburg, Virginia, and I'm not on interstate highways, okay? And sometimes I take the back roads. I got friends who live in places like South Boston, Virginia, right? It's way away from the interstate. So in these last 8 years, I can tell you what I've seen as I go. I leave, if I fly to Washington, D.C., Reagan, and drive south on Route 29, I leave the most liberal bastion of Virginia, Northern Virginia, Fairfax County, Arlington County, and the like, drive into Central Virginia and start heading into the southeast. That's redneck country. And I say that as a descriptive, not as a denigration. All right. In 08, I saw these unbelievable signs. In fact, I used to see them, and I couldn't read them. And I finally had to stop. Because what they said, it didn't say, vote Republican anything. What they said was, whatever the day after the election, we will take our country back. Okay, that's all it said. We will take our country back, all right? And I saw these throughout the countryside. This year, going down south, driving in North Carolina and Virginia, these huge Trump signs, Trump Pence, like billboards in people's yards. And you rarely see a Clinton sign. So I said, this is profound. And here's how I interpret it. Why would these people want anybody to know they were supporting a bigot? That's the way I looked at it, all right? Now, I wrote a note. I had to get this out of my system, and I wrote a note, and I shared it with you, that I sent out to a number of my friends and colleagues on Friday, all right? And I cited an example of something that I said. On Tuesday night, I couldn't get it out of my head. I went to bed before I knew that Donald Trump was going to be the president. I couldn't stay up for that. And in 2012, when I was still on the faculty at RIT, there was a post-election discussion on campus. Now, sitting in the audience, and this young woman, she's 19 or 20 years old, and and because of the times we live in, I have to say, she's a young white woman. She got up, and she was just an emotional wreck. She was trembling. She was sobbing. And she says, I lost my country last night. I lost my country last night. Everything that is sacred to me was taken away from me last night. All right. And the room just got silent. Nobody got up to console her. Nobody said anything. Nobody challenged her. She ran out of the room. And I sat there, and I was seething. And she came back. And when she came back, because I didn't want to say this in her absence, I said to her, I just cannot let your statements go unchallenged. You know, this is a democracy where we have to accept the verdict. When you fight and you lose, you accept the winner. That's what our democracy is all about. And I said to her, you ought to be thankful that you could say what you just said in America without fear of any retaliation, because there are many places in this world where you would have been arrested on the spot. You might have even been shot on the spot for uttering such heresy against the ruling order. So that was it. She and I never exchanged words. I didn't try to pound her. I just wanted to give her a basic civic lesson. And she did not respect the election of Barack Obama. And Thursday and Tuesday night, I couldn't bring myself to respect the election of Donald Trump. But then something came to me in my sleep. I said, you know what? That same lecture you gave to her, accept the results, the majority prevails, and oh, we got a split here because Trump didn't get most of the votes. Live with it. So I'm living with it. And I watched Saturday Night Live, Dave Chappelle, who we know can be brutally profane. I thought probably gave one of the most sober statements I've ever heard. And it totally unexpected coming from Dave Chappelle. Mm-hmm. I'm prepared to give him a chance, but he's got to respect our rights as well as we want him to as well as he wants to be respected. So I think the country is now in a very unique place. And Evan, as a political scientist, as a person who spent his years inside of public institutions, where I now see that we have just eroded respect and support for all of our public institutions. You know, we're now in 16 years of this country, a significant part of the country, disrespecting the office of the president. People didn't respect George Bush. They didn't respect Barack Obama for 16 years. And while I don't think Donald Trump is a worthy candidate of our grace, but he is our president. So I think we've got to really just buckle down. And I've been getting lots of responses back to my message. And one of my friends sent me a message last night, and he said, Bill, I've read your statement over and over and over, and it still doesn't make any sense to me. I cannot accept what's happening. You can be charitable, but I can't. I mean, and there are people who said, okay, I understand where you come from. You're right. We're going to be in that period of division, but we can't continue, because we cannot continue to see our institutions eroded by so many people disrespecting them. And so Donald Trump, until he proves otherwise, should be given the benefit of the doubt. And we need to watch him carefully. And yesterday, what the left hand gave, he took it back with the right hand. He appoints Reince Priebus, who I would never be one to say Reince Priebus is any paragon of progressivism, but he's certainly not a madman. And we don't know anything about Steve Bannon except what we read. But certainly what we read is not good. So he's got to understand the public perception of what he does. And he needs to understand something else. He needs to get up and explain and apologize for the way he castigated, demeaned, defiled, denigrated people during the campaign. He just can't act like it didn't happen. And I watched a number of his supporters say, that's nothing. No, it's not anything. The way he talked and the way he treated, we aren't talking about his talk. When he stood up in podiums and told people, punch that person out, drag them out of here. You know, he created an environment of intolerance. He's got to take ownership for that, and he needs to stand before the American people and do something that I don't think he's capable of doing, saying, I was wrong, I apologize, I'm going to do better. And well, I think we need to take him at his face value if he does that.
As you said, he talked to 60 Minutes, but he also talked to the Wall Street Journal this weekend, and he was asked if some of his rhetoric during the campaign was regrettable now, and he said, No. I won.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he keeps saying, he had this fantastic victory. This is the most hyperbolic man I've seen. He speaks in superlatives in everything he does. He didn't have a fantastic. It was a split ticket. He did not get more votes than Hillary Clinton. He won strategically by capturing enough states to
But he won.
Because that's the system we have.
Yes.
The system doesn't say if you get the most votes, you're president. The system says if you get the most electoral votes, you're president. So he won in the right category.
And I just want to sort of clarify one thing. I mean, Bill, you're right when you say that the demonstrators are upset, they're angry, they're not calling for it to be taken from him. There are some who have called on the Electoral College to change their votes to Hillary Clinton, for her to win in the Electoral College on the basis of, well, we're going to abolish the Electoral College anyway, et cetera, et cetera. I would think that would lead to terrible things. Right. Bad precedent, violence, real danger. I mean, to me, that strikes me as a remarkably bad idea.
Yeah.
You agree with that?
It is terrible, bad, and illegal, and in fact, impossible. Because I think it's 29 states that bind their electors to vote for the person who got the most votes in their state. And 5 states, I understand, who actually attach a criminal penalty if you don't follow that vote. So now we're not going to create that kind of disruption. The discussion about whether or not the Electoral College ought to be abolished, look at it. We've had, 45 president, we've had more elections than that. And only 5 times in our history has the popular vote winner not become the president.
That's 11%, though.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. It's a very small percentage.
11% to me is not that small, but I take the point. It feels fresher because 2 of the last 3 people in the White House will have been put in via the Electoral College, not the popular vote. I take that point.
And I think on your show and across this country,
yep,
we ought to be having those discussions. But I think that we need to also understand that, you know, if Donald Trump had lost this election, if he had lost the Electoral College, can you imagine him showing the same grace? He'd already told us. He wasn't going to accept the results of the election unless he won.
He said he may not. He said he wanted to see.
He wanted to see. But you know, he's been a more temperate person in the last 3 or 4 weeks, reading from a script. And I'm sure that is now weighing on him that he's not a president of the free world. He has the awesome responsibilities. And here's the thing that's so ironic about this. Donald Trump has never been an ideologue. In fact, we don't know where he stands on a lot of issues. He's flipped, he's flopped. So he might surprise us in ways that we don't want to be surprised, that he will go out and be a decent president. You got to remember, Dwight David Eisenhower appointed Earl Warren, and that appointment from a Republican president unleashed the most progressive liberal part of our history. Richard Nixon created affirmative action and environmental protection agency, things that are reviled by the right wing of this country. All right. So we when Ronald Reagan, this is the most contemporary thing I can remember, when Ronald Reagan was elected, people thought all hell was going to break loose. And because he was an ideological person, I mean, you know, he tempered whatever ideology with good humor. He didn't go and throw the baby out with the bathwater. So I always tell people, one of my friends called me yesterday from Richmond, Virginia, and he said to me, this is the way the call started. Is the sun shining in Rochester this morning? I said, yeah. Believe it or not, it is. He said, well, it's shining in Richmond. And you know what? It's going to continue to shine. That's what we got to understand. the darkness is not going to come as people predicted.
All right, a couple more points with Bill, and then we'll go to your phone calls if you like. 844-295-TALK. I want to go to something that Wesley Lowery said on Morning Edition with Steve Inskeep this morning. He's a reporter for the Washington Post. He's biracial, and he wrote a book called They Can't Kill All of Us. He has been chronicling the protest movements post-Ferguson, post-Baltimore, and in other places. Before we do that, before I listen to that, I just want to ask you, you voted for Barack Obama twice?
Yes.
Consider yourself a supporter of the president, generally speaking?
Yes.
Do you support drone strikes?
Nope.
Okay. So is it fair for someone to say, well, Bill Johnson, you're a drone strike supporter because you voted for a president who has enforced this policy. It's killed civilians. I ask this because this is the most common response I'm hearing, and I understand it intellectually. When people say, well, Bill Johnson just said he drove through the backwoods of Virginia and you saw huge Trump signs, and in your mind you were thinking, how could you be so proud and loud about supporting a bigot? But those people may say, I'm not voting for him for his bigotry. His bigotry is there, but I'm voting for him for his economic policy or something else. Just as you would say, I didn't vote for Barack Obama for the drone strikes. Does that intellectually make sense, or do you think that that's different?
No, it makes absolutely perfect sense, and I think this is what we have to come to grips with. You see, everybody says the Obama coalition didn't come out to vote for Hillary Clinton, but a lot of people, and this will shock folk when the analysis is done, more black people than you think of, because I've heard them articulated since Tuesday, voted for Donald Trump. And many of them voted against Hillary Clinton. I mean, it was like, I cannot fathom myself supporting somebody who's in favor of abortion, all right? There are other people who say, we had a president of hope, Barack Obama. He promised us all of these things that he did not deliver, all right? So I'm going to accept Donald Trump's argument. What you got to lose? Try me. What do you got to lose? I mean, look, this is not a black and white issue here. This is not cut and dried. There are so many complexities and let me say this. I was a reluctant. I mean, I voted for Hillary Clinton because I could not stand the idea of voting for Donald Trump. All right. I know Mrs. Clinton since she was First Lady of Arkansas. I've worked when I was mayor. She and I worked closely together. She's a smart person. I think she ran out of gas. I mean, I think that the thing that we now, and it's not a product of hindsight, to say that she thought she was owed this office. You know, she'd worked hard for it all of her life. Look, we can spend all of our time trying to figure out a reason and try to point a finger of blame. Nothing in life is perfect. And that's why I'm saying, I will put on record, and I will probably hear from some of my friends who will say, you got to be out of your freaking mind. How could you say that? Donald Trump is going to surprise us in ways that are pleasant. He's not Breitbart. You know, he's not the Ku Klux Klan. He's not David Duke. He's not. All right? He said some horrible things. He said some indefensible things. All right? And I think the worst part is he doesn't seem to be informed. I mean, listening to him last night, I mean, he didn't know any more about what this job entails than he did 4 months ago. He's going to learn very fast, okay? So I just think what we need to do, I think Dave Chappelle, an unlikely source, says cool it. Just wait. We'll have enough. And you know what?
Wait, but be vigilant.
Be vigilant and wait. And you know what? We got another election coming up in 2 years. All right, Donald Trump's going to be on the same strict leash that Barack Obama was under. And in 2 years, the Senate could flip back to the Democrats because of dissatisfaction among some of the people who thought Donald Trump was going to be that savior. So I think what we need to do is just say, we can't change it. We cannot dial back to last Monday and change it. We got to just go with the flow.
All right, this is where I think you may disagree with Wesley Lowery then, this reporter for The Washington Post, who says he has come to the view that you can't really distinguish voting for a bigot from bigotry itself, at least an act of bigotry. That, in other words, Wesley Lowery says this: we have a bigot as president now, and a lot of people are saying, "Look, I'm I'm not a racist, I'm not a bigot, et cetera. I want to listen to what the way he framed this morning on NPR with Steve Inskeep, and we'll get Bill Johnson's reaction.
And I think one of the fundamental battle lines in this conversation is, do you believe that racism requires intent? Or do you believe that racism is about the outcome, the effect? That if a policy has the effect of racism, of creating racial disparity, is that accurately described as racist? Or does it require someone actively desiring to oppress a certain group of people? And I think that is part of this battle line we've seen. We see a lot of white Americans and certainly Trump supporters who would argue that, no, I don't have hate in my heart for people who aren't like me. And you see the left and largely the Black Lives Matter protest movement and many of the forces that have been driving this conversation for 8 years under Obama, who would argue that, no, racism and prejudice are what occurs when, whether intentional or not, a structure or a system is put in place that leaves one group of people behind.
Bill?
I would have to probably listen to it a second time and absorb it. I can't outrightly disagree with what he says. But I think there is more than a nuance here. You got to have the experience of having someone feel liberated enough to say something evil and venal to your face. All right. Now, that may be the end of it. That may be the end of it. He calls you nigger. You know, he said you ought to go back to Africa. He says, you know, he'll call a Muslim a raghead. What does he do next? All right. And I think that for us, there's a fear that there are some people now who are willing to take matters into their own hands. Okay? See, the people that Donald Trump looked into the television last night and spoke to, they weren't watching 60 Minutes. You know, they were not watching 60 Minutes, so they didn't hear his message. He needs to go back. They said he's thinking about taking a road tour. He needs to go back to all of those places, Aliquippa, Pennsylvania, you know, Moline, Illinois, Mobile, Alabama, all those places that he went, and he needs to have this discussion. We can't have a divided nation, all right? And I don't really want your support if this is the way you think. Look, there were racists long before Donald Trump ran for president, all right? They may have been, you know, keeping their thoughts to themselves or talking among themselves. They now feel more emboldened. So I would say to that commentator, yeah, intent has to be followed by action, all right? And I think that if you're black, and I don't want to make this a racial issue, but let me just say this, and I hope that the white listeners will understand this. If you're black, you're used to that. We really are. We're used to that, you know? I once had in my house, when I lived on Meg Street, I came out one morning, opened my garage, backed my car out, closed the garage, and spray painted on the garage door was F-ing nigger's house. Okay? I've been living in that house for several years. Got three girls that I'm raising inside of that house. All right, walking to street to go down the street to school. Number 12. You got to worry about it. But you know what? You know, and my next door neighbor was horrified. She came out. She said, well, I got to get this off right away. And I said, no, Judy, leave it. Let people see what kind of neighborhood we live in. But you know what? Nobody ever broke my door down. Nobody ever took a direct action. Now, I know for some people, they'll find and say, that's foolish what you're saying. It happens. Racism is not going to, didn't disappear when Barack Obama was elected, although everybody said we are a post-racial society. Nope. It may be a little bit more manifest now to Donald Trump, but I'm going to hold Donald Trump to the words, that two words he said. I want to be president for all the people. And when he says he looks his supporters in the eye and tell them that that's not the kind of behavior that he expects from his supporters. And if he continues to do that, we owe him the right to, you know, be a president.
Carvin, let's take about 1 minute. Go ahead, Carvin.
Well, first of all, thank you so very much for taking my call.
Sure.
And I am honored to be speaking in the presence of former Mayor Bill Johnson, and I always respect what he has to say. But I got to tell you, there are many other views and many other ideas that people are talking about that are very very, very concerning and very frightening. And I happen to hold some of those points of view. I respect the presidency. There is no question about that. I will respect the president of the presidency of this nation. It's very important. But when a person tells you something, and when a person tells you who they are, you have to take that very seriously. And I am extremely concerned about some of the rhetoric that I have heard. And I will tell you how it affects me personally. I have three grown daughters. Two of them were raised as Muslim. They're Black American, but their mother raised them as Muslim. They look like Middle Eastern children if you see them. They're in their 40s now. And my daughter was walking down the street. She wears a headscarf just like any Islamic person, female, does. And people yelled out of the car to her on the day after the election, "Go back to where you came from." Now, where can she go back to? This is her home. This is her nation. And when people are now emboldened to take that point of view, that leadership comes from the top. That point of view comes from the top.
I've got to let Bill jump in just because we're out of time, Carvin. And I want you to know, I'm so sorry to hear that. I know Bill probably feels the same way, but 30 seconds, Bill. Go ahead. Got to keep it tight.
Yeah, Carvin. I've heard worse than that. I mean, that's bad. I've heard people say similar things. That's why I'm saying Donald Trump has got to publicly repudiate those points of view and tell those people, go back where they came from, which in some instances may be up in the hills someplace.
All right, we shall see. Carvin, again, I'm sorry to cut it short only because we're up against the clock, but thanks for the phone call. Bill Johnson, former mayor of Rochester, who is the CEO of Strategic Community Intervention. It's always good to talk to you, Bill. I appreciate your time and perspective here. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Yeah.
And he's been working on the Nuisance Abatement Program public meetings today, tomorrow, and Thursday. Thanks for listening. We will talk with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.